The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm down in the cellars of 2027 Cellars Winery with Kevin Pemkeka. And I've totally destroyed that name. And I was so insecure right before I was going to say it. Kevin, could you please say your full name to the audience so I can be shamed?
Yeah, no problem. My name is Kevin Panagapka. It's a lot of syllables. After the third syllable, people just give up, so I get it.
I feel like I ejected right on the first syllable. I just got so insecure that I just ran away as quick as I could.
All good.
So a lot to get into. And just for the audience, I was introduced to you just a couple weeks ago. I was here with a friend and he said, here, you got to try his stuff. And I'm like, all right, you know, I always like to try new things. I'd seen your labels, but I never tried your wine before.
Okay, yeah.
I think I bought 18 bottles.
Good.
It just absolutely blew me away. So just first to you, your entire winemaking team, just fantastic work from, and it was a couple different vintages. So just fantastic work.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
What led to you and your wife's decision to start the cellar, I think 2027 cellars back in 2007?
Yeah, so we started 2027 in 2007. I had been working in various wineries here after I finished school in Niagara and traveled to New Zealand to work there for a bit. And when I came back, I noticed in New Zealand and in the States, there were these kind of garages, these virtual winemakers, virtual wineries, using another winery's facility to produce wine. So I approached a local winery about that idea and also helped them with their wines. And that's how we started 2027. So we started with 100 cases of Riesling. I managed all the viticulture, made the wine. I bought one tank. So it really started as a very small venture that kind of has just grown organically. The name, so my wife and I owned a small vineyard in Beamsville, and when I registered the vineyard with the Grape Growers of Ontario, they always give you a grower number, and my grower number is 2027. So that's where the name came from, and all the wines are single vineyard, single vintage wines. So that's the whole idea of the company, is to source out and explore different terroirs in Niagara, different vineyards. And now we work with probably 8 or 9 different single vineyards, and we make a range of different wines. But it's really just grown from a passion for winemaking, and slowly over the years it's kind of caught on. So we were only able to sell to restaurants for the first 14 years in the LCBO. We didn't have the retail license. And then in 2019, we got our retail store and our retail license, so the public were able to buy the wines directly from us. So that's been a big change for us, which has been great.
And that's here. This is the whole bricks and mortar that we're at here.
Yeah, so we rent space from Calamus Estate Winery, which I make the wines for them. Mm-hmm. And our retail shop is like literally attached in the same building. So there's 2 retail stores in one spot. So that's been a big deal for us, because when COVID hit and the restaurants were struggling, that was 90% of our business. And then luckily we closed the retail thing in February of 2019. So we're lucky that we got that licensing at that point.
Well, there's a lot of places I'm going to go with those answers, the answer you just gave. I'll just start from the beginning. Where did the passion come from? Where you said you went to school for it. If you go to school for wine, it means something happened in your life that you got the bug.
Well, my dad was an amateur winemaker for a long time. So my whole life I'd been around it.
What was his wines like?
They were great. Yeah, he did a great job at making a whole bunch of different stuff. He was pretty successful in the amateur winemaking thing. So I'd always been around it. And then when I was 15, I started working in restaurants, fine dining restaurant in Aberfoyle. And I was a dishwasher and a busboy and all that. So by the time I became a waiter, I was really kind of getting into wine. This is when I was 17 or 18. And then when I was 21, I decided to come down to Niagara to go to school. It was one of the first or second year that Niagara College had their program going. So I enrolled in that, and my wife had just finished university, so we moved down to Niagara on a Lake, and away we went. But it's really, after that part, it's really a trade. Mm-hmm. So it's really about, I tell people, like, you know, if you don't graduate culinary school and you're the head chef, you got to work your way up. So it's really an apprenticeship and a trade more than anything.
And what was your wife's reaction to all this? Was she on board right from the start, same sort of passion? Or
yeah, she graduated hotel and food management from the University of Guelph. So, and we met at a restaurant. So we were all kind of interested in food and wine.
Right.
And then that continues till today. We deal with restaurants. She sells wine to restaurants and to the public. So we've been involved in wine and food for as long as I can remember. Well, as long as we were able to drink it much.
Let's go. You mentioned you did a year in New Zealand. I think it was Hawke's Bay, if my Googling is correct. Just for real quick, if you could tell the audience about it. I spent a couple of weeks in Hawke's Bay and there, and also Waiheke Island, which actually really amazed me. Their Bordeaux blends were better than I thought. But Hawke's Bay to me is this secret gem. Well, I mean, secret to some, not to others, but it is just to me one of the most beautiful places for wine tourism and just gorgeous wines.
Yeah, I love New Zealand. I needed some international experience, so I worked at a winery called Esk Valley.
Oh yeah, I know Esk Valley well. Their wines, you can find a lot of their blends at the LCBO.
Yeah, they make a wine called the Terraces, which is really high-end blend.
Yeah.
So that's the Terraces that you can see when you go up there.
Yeah.
And I lived in right next door. Oddly, I was living with an American, Tim. He just graduated UC Davis, and he was doing his international. He now owns a winery in Napa. Another friend of mine, Manfred, who's South African, and he's now working at a very well-respected winery in Tuscany. He's a winemaker there. So the international wine making thing is smaller than people think.
Yeah.
Like Jody represents a whole portfolio of international wines. So when we go to Italy or France, we stay and go to the wineries that she represents. And over the years, you really just become friends with all these people. So it's really interesting because, you know, when I think about it globally, it's not that big of an industry. It's really, you really...
Everyone knows everyone.
Yeah.
By the way, what was that house like in New Zealand with three, with three aspiring winemakers, and all of them now have become, you know, become successful? What were those nights like?
There were a couple beers after work. I'm not going to lie about that. That happened. But we were just all done our schooling and needed to kind of cut our teeth in the real world and need to put some good wineries on our resume. Mm-hmm. And that was a great opportunity for me. And the other part of it was cool climate, and that relates to here.
Right.
So that made sense for me to do that. And it was great. I mean, I was only there for about 2.5 months because I worked harvest, and I worked the whole time, every day. Well, I got off the plane, started work, and I worked like 63 days straight or something. So it kind of... You know, they beat you down a little bit crush thing, but you learn, you know, regardless of what country you're in, where you are, the climate's going to change, but the process is fairly standard worldwide. People have different techniques. Obviously, there's different grapes and different terroir, but the process of fermenting juice into wine or grapes is kind of fairly standard.
Kind of universal.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the first wine you made when you started was 100 cases of Riesling.
Yep.
So this is the obligatory question that 95% of all the guests on this podcast ever do is, what is it about Riesling? We all love it so much. We all yell and scream. This is the year where the public gets into Riesling, and they don't. But what is it about Riesling that just calls to you?
It's the purest form of terroir. When you take out oak or my fingerprint, what barrels I choose, what forests, all of the inputs into wine, when you look at Riesling in just its purest form, it works well here. The clones are right that are in Niagara. They're great when they're young. They're one of the most versatile food wines there is, and they age forever. So as far as world-class, high-end white wine, I mean, Chardonnay's obviously in there, but, you know, Riesling Riesling just has an unbelievable aging potential. Because of the pH is fairly low and the acid's high, I make mine in a Moselle style, so they're fermented until I find the perfect amount of residual sugar, and then I stop the fermentation. So there's a natural residual sugar in the wine, and the alcohols are lower, so they're around 10%. So I've always loved Riesling. We make anything that grows well here, and every region finds what grows well in their region and sticks with it. Burgundy's had 800 years at it, or Italy. We are at year 40, and you know, Niagara viticulture has come a long way, and the age of the vines has come a long way. We're as a region, we're really producing world-class wine now. And I've seen a big difference even in the last 15 years. One, the age of the vines, and two, the just the experience of the different winemakers here that have been doing this for now a long time. And my friends, everybody knows everybody, are honing in their skill now so precisely with their vineyards and what they want to do. It's elevating the entire industry, and that's really fun to be a part of.
It's so true, and I'm not going to do the broken record thing, because when people ask me about Ontario wine, and like whatever your preconceptions were 15 years ago, you need to change it. And people go, well, what's the big magic thing? I'm like, it's actually quite boring. Vines got older, people got smarter, because you need time. It's like the it's like you need 10,000 hours reps, the Malcolm Gladwell theory. And again, Burgundy had drunk monks 500 years ago, bored, making booze. We didn't have that here. And I think one of the big things is I see less 100% Cabernet Sauvignon. Now, there's good 100% Cabernet Sauvignon made here, but I feel like 20, 30 years ago, everyone planted that because it's like, well, that's what people buy, so let's just plant what people buy.
Yeah, well, what happened was we were following, when we were first kind of young, like consider that we're around the same age as New Zealand, and New Zealand has no domestic market, really. It's all exported. So all the wines go up to Auckland, they're shipped off. They found their pocket in Sauvignon Blanc, and you know, Pinot to the south, but people don't, as you were talking about before, don't really realize how many great Bordeaux varieties there are in the north part of that island.
Yeah.
So the whole country is doing a great job at exporting. Canada has typically relied on its domestic market. And a while back, you're right, people were drinking Cabernet Sauvignon, so they said, okay, well, let's start planting this stuff. Now, it does okay on hot years, but it can be, you know, it's a cool climate. So on the off years, it can get a little green. So in 2027's portfolio, we produce the first grapes we harvest are Pinot Gris, and the last ones we harvest are Cabernet Franc. Mm-hmm. And anywhere in between there is what grows well here, consistently year to year, even in cooler off years. And all regions in the world eventually grow what works in their climate. And I think that Niagara has now really figured out exactly what works here.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, there are some pockets of different varieties that you don't hear as much about. But the real core varieties, Riesling, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Cabernet Franc, Pinot Gris, Gamay as well. I mean, those are the wines that we focus on sparkling. I love making sparkling from grapes here. That's what 2027 focuses on and what it will continue to, because I know I can ripen them and produce quality wines on a year-to-year basis.
Let's go to the nerdy part of this interview, and we'll do more about your own journey and,
sure,
and the human interest stuff. But in the cellar, only Burgundian oak is used. Vos, Neves, and Alea. I think I mispronounced that last one, but I mispronounce everything.
That's all good.
I was wondering if you spend listeners, because when they go, oh yeah, you know, it's a American oak or it's Burgundian, or some people are using Canadian. What is it specifically about Burgundian oak that works for you and works for your wine?
I love Burgundy. I'm obsessed with Pinot Noir, and I love Champagne. So that's the start of that. They produce the best barrels on earth, as far as I'm concerned. They've dialed in the oak, the forest, the toasting levels, and this is all, again, a thumbprint. This has an impact on the quality of the wine, mm-hmm. the quality of the oak. So I spend money on two things. First is viticulture, and second is barrels. I can't afford to build a castle yet, so that'll have to wait. But the inputs into the wine that affect the quality are always top of level for me. So I purchase the best barrels I can buy, and I've been building my barrel inventory for 15 years now. And I have the right amount of used one year, 2 year, third year, fourth year fourth use oak, and that is very important when you're blending for Chardonnay, for example. Because if I'm using, like on a cooler year, I'll use maybe 10-15% new wood, or in a warmer year, I might up the new oak percentage because it can handle it. And I have the barrels to blend with. I have all the right amount of, like I said, first, second, third, fourth use barrels. So that capacity to blend really affects the quality of the wine, and that's very important to me. Now, I've got nothing against American oak, and there's some great options for some great wines. I like the Burgundian style.
What's the flavor difference? Like, if someone, and the thing is, people that listen to this pod who have studied and diplomaed and whatever, they know the answer. They're yelling at me. But for a lot of people that don't, if I have a glass of wine with Burgundian oak and one with, say, American oak, and obviously there's 100 factors with the temperature, what the vintage was, but what are the things that you can get from a Burgundian oak barrel?
Okay, so there's a long answer to that question, so I'll shorten it a little bit. One thing is I buy three-year air-dried wood. So I buy, and what it really means is rain leach. So when they cut the staves, they leave them outside, and the rain leaches the bitter tannins out of the wood. And then they're coopered after they've been aged for 3 years. That's important. So the short answer is they're more subtle, they're more respectful of the fruit of the wine. They're not as aggressive. The tannins are finer. All of those kind of finesse things with good Burgundian oak is important for the wines that I want to produce. And we produce, we're a cool climate. I produce delicate. Typically, I don't put the Chardonnay through malolactic fermentation, so they've got a little bit of tension. A little more acidity, and I like the fact that the Burgundian oak respects the fruit. That's the most important part for me. It's a part of the wine. I tell people it's like a picture. It's the frame. Mm-hmm. The grapes are the picture, but the framing of the picture is the oak. It doesn't need to be the first thing that you see when you're trying the wines. Now, when you get into heavier reds, you could move into more American wood that's got a little bit more intensity, and that's fine for especially for warmer climates. But in Niagara, we're a cool climate, and it's important for me to really produce wines that showcase the terroir. That is the whole point of 2027, showcasing the terroir of each wine, regardless if it's unoaked Pinot Gris or Riesling, or if it's Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, or Cabernet Franc. I want to be able to see the vineyard through the wine. And that's been my experiment, finding the best pockets of the best vineyards in this country or in this province. So
we'll get to viticulture and specific vineyards in a moment, but we'll get off the geeky stuff. And thank you for that answer. I want to sort of bounce back and forth. How intimidated do friends or family come when they go to your house in terms of bringing wine? Does anyone bring wine to your house for a party, a celebration, a holiday?
Yeah, for sure. And I love when they do, you know.
But you might love it. Do they love it? How often do they apologize? Do they sheepishly give you a bottle of wine?
It's funny because I don't care, and I think it's funny. But yeah, we had friends over yesterday that own a wine tour company, and it's funny because the first thing they said, they brought flowers, and they're like, we aren't going to bring wine.
Like,
it's fine, I got lots.
I knew it.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe that's a thing, but I will drink anything that's great. I love just wine in general. Mm-hmm. If it's Brunello di Montalcino, if it's good champagne, I can't afford it. I'd drink Krug every day if I could, but or good Burgundy. I'm happy to try it all. I love it.
And when you go over to someone's place and you bring a bottle, does everyone open your bottle first?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, normally, because I bring, you know, two or three or four bottles and just wines for people to try, and I think that they like to try different wines. So
yeah,
I like drinking, sparkling. I like lower alcohol wines. I love drinking wine, but I don't particularly like wines that are too high in alcohol. So I typically drink, you know, champagne. Rosé is a big one right now because it's getting warmer. We just bottled some rosé. That's great. So people drink wines within the season, right? If it's hot, you're drinking chilled rosé. And if, you know, in the fall or the winter, you tend to move into, you know, bigger shards or Pinot or Cab Franc or whatever. But Yeah. I hope people don't feel like it's intimidating. I'm certainly not an intimidating guy, so whatever.
I try. I mean, it's part of the point of this podcast is to make wine less intimidating. It's supposed to be fun, but I get it. Like, I'll still have people who come over, and they'll bring a bottle, and they go, oh, I hope this is okay.
Yeah.
I always get that, I hope it's okay. So, and
I'm just not, like, I don't, the only thing about the wine industry that I'm not real big fan of is the pretentious part.
Of course. This is supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
Wine is supposed to be a fun, it's a history, it's a story, it's family, it's not supposed to be some, you know.
No, and I do this because it's a creative outlet for me. It's like painting or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, like, I like making things, that you can consume. I love cooking. I like making wine. Like, it's just in my DNA. So every year when I get a new year, it's got a new vintage, it's always new for me.
It's a new canvas every
year. My favorite thing to do, my favorite time to taste wine is when I rack the Chardonnay, let's just say, out of barrel, and it becomes the blend. When I rack them upstairs into tank, and I can first have the first idea of what that Chardonnay is going to be like from that vintage. And that's super fun. And I've never been, I get bored of things very easily, and I've never been bored of producing wine. I don't think I ever will. People are like, what are you going to do when you retire? I'm like, well, you know, I make wine.
I'll consult.
Yeah, I don't know. But yeah. I don't think I'll ever retire from this lifestyle. I don't think I would ever want to. I like
you might do less winter pruning. How about that? When you get a little older.
Typically, I have more people to do things for me, or I'm more of a directing things. But, you know, ultimately, it's always been interesting, fun, and I like it. So,
do you have, what's the best bottle of Burgundy you've had? And is there the one you haven't had yet, the Holy Grail?
I've tried, I think, two or three times. I've tried some Romani Conti wines that have been mind-expanding. I love Chambertin. I think Moray Saint-Denis, I could just drink those all day.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yes.
I wouldn't have an issue. I love Chardonnay, but I'm obsessed with Pinot Noir in any form, including sparkling. So that would be my thing. And I'm a big fan of Meursault. As well. I think we're getting close to the quality for Chardonnay here when you look at, when we do blind tastings with some different areas in France, we're getting there.
Oh yeah, I've noticed it. I've been to blind tasting as well, and it's been, you know, 14 Chardonnays, and 10 of them are, you know, either high-end Village or Premier Cru.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple from Niagara and a couple from Prince Edward County. And people get fooled. People get fooled all the time.
And that's just proving that Niagara has really come into the world stage, I think, with their table wines. There's been wineries, Hidden Bench, 30 Bench, that have won Best in Show and Decanter, which is the best wine competition on planet Earth. So, I mean, just to get that recognition internationally is an important piece. Typically, we've mostly sold domestically. We don't export that much, except for ice wine. So, just in that vein, it hasn't been our business plan, like New Zealand, for example, to just export to the world. We have 5 million people that are an hour from here in the GTA. That is our market. It's not that big of an industry. We can't grow that much more because there's not that much more room to grow grapes here. So we're really, it's not like a region where you can just keep expanding. We have a small pocket here in Niagara where we can grow tender fruit, which is why we do it. Peaches, cherries, grapes. A kilometer this way, it's too cold in the winter. So we really have this fairly small pocket here, and it's not getting that much bigger. So we will max out, and we have maxed out on what we're producing as a wine community. So like in BC, you know, Oliver's an hour away from, you know, Kelowna. So there's more areas in there.
Yeah.
But here we're kind of set in our...
It's kind of Burgundy, just this tiny little sliver of land where you can make wine.
Yeah, and it's all due to the escarpment and the lake.
Yeah.
Right, and the winter temperature, so...
All right, let's stay to land, and then we'll get back to a nerdy question. When people see the word Wismer, a bottle of wine, on a bottle of Ontario wine, what does that mean?
So, Glenelgan Vineyard, the hamlet of Glenelgan is down this road where Balls Falls is. That was an old settlement a long time ago. So Glenelgan Vineyard Management, or the Wismer family, own quite a lot of acres right around where we are now in the 20-mile bench. They've got a bunch of different pockets of vineyards. So when you see Wismer on a label, I say Wismer Foxcroft Block.
Right.
Wismer Armbrust Vineyard. Wismer da-da-da-da-da. So I state on the label what block it's from. But they have quite a few. So you see wines from Wismer from other wineries. We all kind of... There may be six or seven wineries that source from Foxcroft. So I have a little block. Batchelder might have one, Cloudsley, whatever. We all have little pieces of that vineyard. And the sense of the terroir of that vineyard, because it's so good, is becoming more and more popular.
What makes for a good vineyard?
Site. So microclimate. So Vineland in the double bench. So Vineland Estate Winery is on the top part of the bench, and then Foxcroft is on the double bench. It's on the slightly lower spot. So it's just a little bit warmer. The slope of the vineyard, the age of the vines, the rootstock, the consistency of the vineyard, and the wines that are produced from that vineyard. Over time, you can see, not just me, but other wineries have done a fantastic job with fantastic fruit. So my job is to get out of the way. As a winemaker, it's not to manipulate anything. It's to get out of the way of the wine so the terroir can express itself, which is why, for example, I was saying I don't typically do much malolactic fermentation. My oak regimes are fairly low in their percentages because the whole point of this is to me to showcase the vineyard. It's also why my name's on the back of the bottle and the logo is 2027, which is my grower number. So just experiencing the different terroirs in the different areas, it takes years and years to understand a vineyard, like 10, 15 as a winemaker, to understand how it reacts in different seasons, when to pick the grapes, when not to push it too much. So that experience also plays into the quality, but mostly it's microclimate, age of the vine.
Did you get to pick your rows? Like I think I was reading something about just do you like
yeah.
And I wonder about that because I just imagine like someone in a giant Costco, you know, and you're deciding what to pick. And like, is it wandering through? Is it like
No, they're marked off. So I have a block that I always buy. Mm-hmm. I have for 10 years from this vineyard and that vineyard. And I know exactly where those. So I walk the vineyards every morning when it gets close to harvest. So in late September, I always walk all the blocks because I want to see and taste the fruit. The most important decision you make as a winemaker is when to pick the fruit. Once it's in the building, I can deal with it. But,
yeah.
You know, you can't control the weather, obviously. So that's what makes it frustrating and fun all at the same time. So you get fantastic years and you get more challenging years. And you know, if you can manage the more challenging years, the better job you do at that, I think is a sign of a good quality brand. So if I'm doing my job right, I'd like people to think that 2027 makes great wine. Whether you like Riesling, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Cabernet Franc, sparkling, I think that I'm trying to maintain a quality level that always is here. And there's nowhere to declassify anything for me. Mm-hmm. There's no second label.
Yeah.
So it's 100 miles an hour, or I'm not doing it. That's it. And I've maintained that from the first 100 cases until now, which I do about 2,500, which is still small.
Yeah, that's tiny.
But the point is the same.
Yeah.
It never changes. We're after the best vineyards, the best grapes, the best oak. And the least intervention in the winemaking piece, producing clean, high-quality product.
What are some of the lessons you've learned, the classic question, if you could go back to 2007, Kevin, what would be some of the lessons you would tell him?
15 years ago, Kevin, well, I was into some very trendy winemaking styles that didn't sell well. So I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I was in an angry dry Riesling phase, which I love. So they were very, very dry, high acid,
yeah.
and they age forever. They're great now.
Yeah.
But it was a brick in the market.
Yeah.
Right? It just didn't work. So I was in an unfiltered Chardonnay phase where it was actually unfiltered. So there was, you know, lees in the bottle and
you were making wine for you.
Yeah.
You were not making wine to sell, were you?
No. And I was paying for it. So once I realized after I cut the check that that wasn't a great idea, I haven't ever changed the quality piece, but the some of the styles have kind of moved into what most people would prefer.
Yeah.
So I learned that the hard way. Yeah, I don't do that anymore.
I would love, though, you know, this is such a stereotypical response. I would love to try some of your original Rieslings.
Just they're great now, but, you know, it's 15 years later,
yeah,
and
exactly.
I needed to get paid for them, you know, that year. So anyway, that happened. But
actually, going back, do your wife, do you guys share the same styles? Like, what are some things? Like, my girlfriend and I, we argue about, she doesn't like Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah,
even Sancerre and Bordeaux and things like that. You know, that's fine. But is there? Do you know if you guys have any like stylistic differences or debates?
Jody and I, well, because she sells international product, we're exposed to a lot of different product a lot of the time. Frankly, we don't talk about wine that much at home because we do it so much during the day.
Right.
But when we travel, for example, we were in Montalcino at a winery that she represents called Il Colle, which is fantastic. And we were tasting with the winemaker there, and she was wonderful. I brought my kids. When we were leaving, she asked me what year the kids were born and brought a bottle of wine from each one of their birth years and signed it and gave it to us. So that part of it, I think we both really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
We don't typically do much wine touring when we're traveling. We will go to a couple places, but typically we kind of want to
get away,
do something else. So,
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm going to like I went to Champagne a while ago with a group of winemakers. Then we were just doing wineries. That was fine.
Yeah,
that's a different
different
thing. And I love doing that too. But yeah,
by the way, the important thing is you never want transcripts of those conversations to go to your non-wine friends.
Yeah,
because the stuff we say there's nothing worse than wine jokes. We'll laugh about it, and everyone else will stare at you and go, you're an asshole.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know what? That's fair. I am.
Yeah.
Is there the time to pick? Is there anything more stressful than figuring that date out?
No. It's the absolute most stressful part of the job, and you get used to it. So over 20 years I've been making wine, you see a lot of different vintages. You see a lot of different weather patterns. You see patterns and things. So there's always the unexpected, too, that you just have to deal with. Last year we had a lot of botrytis, and that's just life. So you'll know it's coming, but you don't know exactly what it will be like for that specific vintage. And then you look back at the vintages and you say, oh, yeah, 2020 was this, 21, you know, 16 was this, 10 was this. 2001 was this. So there's always something that happens, whether it's weather, whether it's disease pressure, whether it's insects or whatever it is. There's always something that pops up that everybody has to deal with. And over time, you just get used to that. That's just part of the job.
Do you have a vintage that, like much, much older Kevin, when you're sitting there, grizzled veterans, and you're telling war stories, and you think 2012 was bad. There I was. 2009, rain hit. What's your scary vintage war story?
2006 was awful. I was working at a big winery, Hillebrand. We were doing, you know, 200, like a lot of wine. And it just didn't stop raining ever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ladybugs, that wasn't, the 2001, nobody knew.
Yeah.
That was a problem. We know now. You know, those things you'll remember back when you're older and be like, okay, yeah, that was a very challenging year because, you don't know until you've made it or the problems that you're running into while you're making it, which is why we spend so much time and money on viticulture. The more you do in the field, the less you do in the winery.
Yeah.
And that's the most important take-home message, I think, for people. So most of my time minus managing the business is in viticulture, because it's so important that I need to spend my time on that.
What are the bullet points of a great vintage? We talked about it before. The 2020, especially for reds in this area, was really good. I tried your 2020 Pinot. It was fantastic. By the way, the mark of you guys, you're 19s, I still remember. Yeah. But what is it about a year like 2020? Like, what are some of the bullet points?
So there's, like I was talking about before, there's always some issue that you run into, mm-hmm. whether it's rain or disease or breakdown, or those are the things that you run into constantly. Once in a blue moon, you hit a vintage where it's dry, it's cool, there's no disease pressure, and you can pick everything whenever you want. Mm-hmm. And that is the difference. So you have a whole industry with such a good vintage like 2020, and that's not just me saying this, it's everybody.
Yeah.
That you have the ability to perfectly ripen almost all of the different varieties. Some years, Pinot's better, Cab Franc's a little green, whatever, right? Like, that's just life. Once in a while, you hit a year that is very easy to deal with in the winery, and you're just expecting the problems to come, and they don't. And then you try the wines, and they're amazing. They're perfectly ripe. Like, they're phenolically ripe. That's 2020. And it will... I think long term you will see that to be one of the best vintages Niagara's had in ever. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you, when are you, you mentioned about you love this because of the creativity, and I loved your analogy of, the frame is the oak, but the first thing you notice is the picture, which is the fruit. Do you feel most creative out in the fields, in the winery here, blending? Like, when do you feel the most creative?
My opinion on wine making, I'm just a custodian of it. Mm-hmm. I'm just there to make sure that it gets to its final place in the bottle.
You're the middleman between God, nature, and the person who buys the bottle.
I don't believe that, I can make wine. I don't believe that my winemaking matters that much to the terroir. I think it's mostly involved in the fruit. Now, the barrels I choose, fine, that's part of the winemaking piece. And how I whole cluster, I hand pick, I do all those things that are meant to produce higher quality product, but so does everybody else. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I'm doing anything that's revolutionary by any stretch. Wine's been made the same way for a long time. I'm getting out of its way. I'm trying to showcase the vineyard, and that's the point for me for this. There are some technical things, like I make traditional method sparkling. You do need to know what you're doing with that process, mm-hmm. But so there is that. You need to have the experience to do that. But oddly, the more experience I have, the less winemaking I do. I know, I've just intuitively understand the vineyard. I understand the year. I can kind of predict what problems are going to come up in the winemaking process to the best of my knowledge. And I use my palate and my nose consistently. So I trust it. I've been working on it for 20 years, And I drink, unlike people that drink finished wines all the time, I drink, young, raw wine. So I'm looking at it differently. I'm trying to foresee the future of the wine, not in its raw form, not as a finished product. Enjoying it, not I enjoy it, but not like enjoying a glass of wine.
For you, a lot of times it's not about the present; it's about the future.
It's always about the future,
right?
Yeah.
I'd love to hear about the 2027 Cellars Wismer Vineyard Foxcroft Block, the Project Chardonnay 2019 with Niagara College.
Yeah. So Peter Rod, a golfing friend of mine, and works at Niagara College in the wine program there, and we were golfing one day, and he had a wine a class that was studying wine marketing, and we said, hey, why don't I blend up two barrels of Chardonnay? I wound up the oak a bit on it, 40-50%. I'll age it for another 18 months, and we'll get the class to come up with a marketing plan. I'll bottle it. They can track the sales. They can do it in real time, which mm-hmm. would be cool, right? So that's what we did. And now the timeline didn't, you know, wine doesn't care about what semester it is. So that was an interesting learning for them. It's like, no, it needs to be bottled at this point. It will be labeled at this point. But anyway, the process of it was interesting, and that's where that was born, the whole idea of the project. It was an actual project for a wine wine class. And then we sell it up here. It's only a couple barrels, but it was more of a fun kind of thing to just try.
How much do you like, is that part of just the community? How much do you like that? Just the collaboration, the collaborative effort, the collaborative spirit of this area, which is, you know, different than, say, Burgundy.
Yeah, everybody knows everybody. It's a very small community. People typically, winemakers typically don't leave. They typically stay. So my friends and the colleagues in this industry, we've known each other forever. So it's very tight-knit. Mm-hmm. It's very close. If you need something, you just make a phone call, you'll get it. If somebody needs something from me, if I have it, they'll get it. That's just understood. If somebody's whatever breaks, you know, the pump breaks,
right?
It's no problem. You need some corks, no problem.
Yeah.
So that I love, because it's like a family, you know. You just know everybody. And when you need things, you can get it done. So that collaborative piece with Niagara College or the Brock or whatever school is out there, I think it's important always to support the next generation of winemakers. And because this is an apprenticeship and a trade, they need to learn. I needed to learn from, as an assistant winemaker, from the winemaker, obviously. I needed the experience to be able to go into this field and maximize my potential. And I'm happy to help anybody that is passionate about wine to reach their potential or move on or connect them with people that they can get the experience with. So it's full circle.
Yeah.
It's just how this works. Mm-hmm. And it would be the same in being a chef or whatever. It's the same idea.
Yeah, the experience you got in New Zealand and when you just started coming up, now you pay it forward. And the whole circle of life. Before we end this, and again, I appreciate you taking the time.
No,
is there anything else people need to know just about you, about 2027 Cellars?
Yeah, come and see us. I mean, come and try the wines. We were very proud of the wines. We would love people to come down. We're at 3100 Glen Road in Jordan, Vineland-ish. We're attached to the Calamus property. Come down, try Calamus wines, try 2027 wines. I think you'll find something that you enjoy within the portfolio. So I would say, and try other wineries. So I just want more people to come down to Niagara from Toronto. It's happening now after COVID. We have a world-class wine region that's an hour away from our biggest city in this country. Your backyard is making fantastic product now. And there are a lot of very good wineries producing really high-end wines.
Oh, yeah.
So I would just say, for the people that maybe haven't been down to Niagara for a while trying, or maybe have been here 10 or 15 years ago, trust me, it's changed. And there's, you know, the vineyards are older, the people are more experienced, and as a group, the wines are fantastic.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Kevin, where can people, websites, where can people go and all that?
Yeah, www.2027cellars.ca. They can order online. We ship direct. We always have new releases coming out right now. I've got a rosé. I've got a secret Chardonnay coming out.
What does that mean?
June.
Well, what's a secret Chardonnay?
Oh, I have a new vineyard of Chardonnay that's blowing my mind.
Oh yeah,
it's so good. Oh,
I guess I can't ask you any questions.
The vineyard,
about it. It's secret.
No, it's not secret. It won't be. It's gonna be. It's gonna be called. It's called Grimsby Hillside Chardonnay, a very old Chardonnay vineyard from a vineyard in Grimsby, a very old vineyard. And just beautiful, pristine, nice acidity, very delicate. It's the subtlety of Chardonnay that's amazing. So I'm really looking forward to releasing that one. And we've got a whole bunch of 2020s right now. They're fantastic. So our lineup in the winery is really great right now. And that's my job, so I better be good at it.
Hey, Kevin, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, thank you very much. And come see us anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody, definitely check it out. I was blown away when I came back here a couple weeks ago. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.